I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. A while ago, I spent time exploring Lexington, Virginia, where I met up with the historian at Stonewall Jackson's family home to discover insights about Jackson's life leading up to the Civil War. We then stopped in for a visit with Lucy Wilkins, Director of Collections and Educator at Washington and Lee University, where she shared fascinating insights about Robert E. Lee's post-Civil War tenure as president of Washington College. Lee was the first in America to institute the system of majors and electives that spread to colleges and universities across the country and transformed American higher education forever. Come along and join the conversation at Jackson's home, and then a visit at Washington and Lee University to discover an often overlooked glimpse of Jackson's post-Civil War life in Lexington, Virginia. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting. Grace of Lee, the site director at the Stonewall Jackson House in Virginia. So you're pretty familiar with Stonewall Jackson, aren't you? Because you relive his life every day.
I do, yes.
So I imagine in some ways you really do know him. You can kind of hear his voice or how he might think, react, or act.
Close sometimes, but yeah, I've studied a lot of mostly his life here in Lexington is really my expertise in getting to know him and his family.
So you can have a sense of him walking down the street to go to VMI or walking around town. You can almost see him turning a corner, huh?
Absolutely.
His formal name, he's known in history as Stonewall Jackson, for standing there like a stone wall.
Yes, sir.
But before that, he was Thomas, right?
He was. His full name is Thomas Jonathan Jackson, and actually the citizens of Lexington at the time would have known him as Major Jackson. That was his rank when he taught over at the Virginia Military Institute.
So up until the time of the start of the Civil War, he was an instructor at the VMI, the Virginia Military Institute?
He was. He taught what was then called natural and experimental philosophy, but we know it better today as physics.
And then from a familial standpoint, when the Civil War started, he had a really tough choice to make because he was a staunch Unionist at heart.
He was. A lot of the citizens of Lexington actually were very pro-Union, and his view was he really felt that if the states had a disagreement that they should figure that out as a union. But he also was a Virginian. Many people at that time viewed themselves as a Virginian first or Pennsylvanian first.
Well, I think what's really profound about that, he was a Virginian first over family.
Well, yes, I assume you're referring to his sister, Laura.
Mm-hmm.
His sister lived in what is today Beverly, West Virginia. It was still part of Virginia then.
But they were very, very close.
They were very close. And Jackson, I think, actually made the assumption that his sister would support Virginia seceding from the Union. But he found that when he went to fight for the Confederacy, she was very pro-Union, and their relationship ended as a result of being on opposite sides of the war. And before his death in 1863, they never reconciled.
Interesting. And then going back in time, Stonewall Jackson, Thomas Jackson, was a very staunch supporter of states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
Have you studied or read any nuances about that specific relative to Thomas?
Well, specifically to Jackson, he was very states' rights.
Did that have anything to do with slavery, do you think, or not?
There is one quote, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but he is talking specifically about states' rights with slavery, but his opinions on slavery, his writings are just so few that we don't have enough information to give on fully how he felt about slavery.
Interesting. Okay, so if somebody came here today and they came to his house, they could get a real sense of what their life was like back in time. You have some of their original furniture and a lot of things that you would have stepped into their house 1860 and you would have found here.
Absolutely. And we also try, because we have a lot of these original artifacts, we want to tell a true story of Jackson. So that's the good and the bad. Jackson as a professor, a husband, a family man, but also Jackson as a slave owner and a man who did make mistakes throughout his life.
So he was struck down in 1863, right?
That's correct. He was wounded at the Battle of Chancellorsville on May 2nd, 1863, and died 8 days later.
And I think the real disconnect of that. It was friendly fire.
It was. He was shot by friendly fire, and he was wounded 3 times, twice in the left arm, once in the right hand. To save his life, they amputated his left arm, and they believed he would make a full recovery, but as history tells us, he never did.
And that's another classic case of disease and germs and whatnot, and not the wound itself.
Absolutely. And for a long time, it was believed he had pneumonia, but many people today believe he actually had blood poisoning from being dropped so many times on the way off the battlefield.
Wow, very powerful. So here we are, Lexington, Virginia, right in the heart of town. So in your opinion and mine, this would be a must stop in and must see.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful community. It's a wonderful town. And specifically with the Jackson House, we are the only site in town that can tell the story of a typical family prior to the American Civil War. And it's very much just like any family today.
So much more so than just a Civil War general.
Absolutely. We tell much more the personal side of Jackson.
A family side, yeah.
Yes, sir.
And their garden out back.
Absolutely.
All right, Grace. Thank you so much for sharing. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah. For further information, do you all have a website?
We do. You can go to stonewalljackson.org.
Thank you so much, Grace of Leith. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Virginia. Here we are in Virginia at Washington and Lee University.
Hi, I'm Lucy Wilkins. I'm the director of University Collections and Lee Chaplin Museum.
This is my first time coming here, so it was a total surprise. And it's different to hear or read about it than to be here.
Yeah.
And it truly is living Americana history.
It really is, because our school spans American history, since it's the 9th oldest school in the United States. So from 1749 until now, we've sort of been mirroring what's been going on in the country.
This school, its roots go back to really the true roots of America.
Yes, it really is. Since the first settlers came out here to the Valley of Virginia in the 1730s, and then the little Augusta Academy was formed in 1749. We have been here pretty much ever since.
And it's had some different incarnations and restarts. And at some point, it became Washington University?
A Washington College.
Washington College, and that was in honor of our first president.
Yes, because Washington gave the largest gift at that time ever given to an institution of higher education in 1796 to what was then Liberty Hall Academy. And then they changed their name to thank him to Washington College.
And at that time, up until the time of the Civil War, it remained a fairly small college, didn't it?
Yes, and it was, of course, all male. And it was just a small liberal arts school. Was it a little bit different than most universities of the period, which had been formed to train ministers? This school has never been that case. It's always been a non-sectarian school.
So it wasn't a religious order or the Methodists?
No.
Or
even though the large majority of settlers here to the Valley were Germans who were either Scottish Presbyterians or Lutherans, but mostly Presbyterians in this part of the Valley.
So at some point, there was a major shift in this school, and that had to do with the post-Civil War in Robert E. Lee.
Yes, the school was about to go under when Lee got here. There was no money. The student population was down because of the war, and also it had just been sort of kept alive as a preparatory school during the war. So they were down to 40 students. It would have been easy for them to give up at that point. But we had a very courageous group of trustees, and they came on the bright idea of asking the famous General Robert E. Lee to be their 11th president.
And this was literally months after the conclusion of the Civil War.
That's correct. Of course, we all know that the war was concluded at Appomattox in April of 1865. Lee came here as the 11th president in September of 1865.
And that was a real unstable time for people, Southerners. Jefferson Davis was imprisoned at that time, and there were other generals who were living in fear of being arrested and imprisoned, and he might have thought that same thing himself when he came here, correct?
Well, he certainly thought there was a chance he could be tried as a traitor. He had given his oath of allegiance, but he had entered also his request for citizenship, but it had not been granted. So he wasn't really sure where he stood at that particular point. The state of Virginia was also not a state at that point. It was Military District Number 1.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
So this was Reconstruction.
So moving forward in Reconstruction, there were many Southerners who were willing to move on and do their best to heal the wounds and reform the Union as a whole. Where did Lee fit in that scope?
Lee really set the tone for that, because there were many who were having trouble readjusting and were very bitter over their losses. But Lee felt he had to set the example, and he did. Tried very hard to communicate to his former soldiers that they needed to also establish their oath to go back to their farms and to become productive citizens of the United States.
A little aside, it's an ugly chapter in American history, in my opinion, but an important one, and that's Arlington and how Arlington came to be. And you can take it from there, but dovetailing back, it speaks volumes for his strength and his ability to stand tall in face of that. Tell us about Lee's home.
Well, of course, the folks at Arlington House can give you a better rendition than I can, but the Lees, of course, the house was confiscated at the beginning of the war, taken over by the Union Army, and at first the Army tried to preserve the house and its contents, which had been put under the care of the Lees' slave, Selina, and she tried to watch over it as best she could. They finally decided to remove many of the Washington objects that the Lees owned to the patent office in Washington. It was the only place that was fireproof. But when General Meigs took over, he decided to take revenge on the Lees and began interring casualties from the war right up on the front steps and in Mrs. Lee's Rose Garden to make sure they could never set foot there again.
But then after the war, they confiscated it and turned his property into Arlington National Cemetery.
That's
intentionally
correct.
Buried the Union soldiers there.
Yes, from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Of course, it's turned out wonderfully, but the Lees did manage to get payment from the government, I think it was in the 1880s, about $150,000 for the property, which they then turned it back over to the United States government.
So he was able to take the high road on that whole.
He did. Mrs. Lee was very bitter over the loss, but Robert E. Lee felt that it was important to accept that it was gone and to move on as he tried to do with the whole war. He wanted the state of Virginia, he wanted the school to look forward, not backward.
Let's move forward in time during his tenure as the head here at the university. And he truly was a visionary in American college, university, academia, and how it propelled forward.
This is the story that most people don't know, because most of us, you know, our knowledge of Lee ends at Appomattox. But as president here, he managed to create something that all of us have benefited from. He put his faculty to trying to find out what was the latest in educational theory, and they came up with an idea that had been tried unsuccessfully before the war, but Lee and his faculty managed to make it actually work, and that was the whole idea of majors and electives. So when all of us have gone to college and have decided on what major or what area of life we wanted to pursue and have our own choices, this was something that was invented here at Washington and Lee. It had not been done before. Lee brought in 9 new, he called them departments, not majors, but 9 new majors into the school, created a school of journalism, a school of law, and a school of business.
This was the first school of journalism in the United States, correct?
That's correct. No one had thought that journalists needed 4 years of college education, but he thought so, and he gave them a scholarship and then also a job at the local newspaper while they were students here.
That's pretty profound, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Yeah. That was a model that was replicated by Harvard and then off from there, right?
Yes, it started the University of Georgia, copied what they did here, then the University of Virginia, and then Harvard. Since it has spread to our entire country, and you think how many students from all over the world have benefited from the education that we offer here in the United States, it's a huge legacy, bigger than anything Lee accomplished in the Civil War.
Let's talk horse for a moment. Traveler was Robert E. Lee's horse that he loved probably as much as anything in the world.
Yes.
And talk to us about that story.
Well, Traveler was originally called Jefferson Davis, believe it or not. And Lee acquired him in 1862. And they were just about in every battle together during the war. Traveler was a very high-spirited horse. He was tall, 16 hands high. Lee was kind of short in the leg and tall in the body, so he looked great on Traveler. They made quite a pair. When Lee brought him here to Lexington, Traveler was allowed to graze all over the college grounds. He took a ride on Traveler just about every afternoon all over the county here, and they became very close.
And like you were alluding to earlier, he, like a lot of others, basically were going through PTSD, and Traveler literally became a source of solace for him.
Well, as historians, we can't say that he had PTSD, because no one, of course, would call it back then.
Sure.
But surely Lee was suffering emotionally just from the carnage of that horrible war and of having to have sent so many young men to their deaths. So it is just my personal opinion that those afternoon rides with Traveler helped Lee heal from the scars of the war.
Wasn't he quoted of saying something to that effect?
He did say that in a letter. He said, Traveler and I have sweet communion as we go into the mountains.
But then he did not live that long after the Civil War.
That's correct. Lee died in 1870, only 5 years after he became president here. And he accomplished quite a lot. He established the basis for our current honor system. He completely redid the curriculum. And he restored the grounds, which had been damaged by a raid here in 1864. And set the tone that the university and the goals of being on the cutting edge of the modern sciences. Since then, the school is still on the paths that he set out.
So here we are today, after a century, it's coeducational.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Finally, at last.
And what's it known for today? Why, you know, like Cal Poly State University, known for architecture or engineering, does this have an outstanding attraction?
Two things. Largely, undergraduate school of business. We do produce a lot of business majors. Then the law school. It's a small law school, but is consistently in the top 25 in the nation.
So a good shingle to hang out if you're a lawyer. Right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes, indeed. And the alumni are incredibly loyal and helpful to our students.
And it's all privately funded?
Yes, it is a private school. We have a wonderful group of trustees who and a very supportive staff and administration.
Nice. Anything you want to add?
I hope people will come and see us and really not just accept the things that they hear about the 19th century, but to really learn about it and to learn about the people involved and remember that they're all people and they certainly all had their good points and bad points. And my name is Lucy Wilkins. I am the director of University Collections and the site manager for Lee Chaplin Museum at Washington and Lee University.
And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Virginia. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.
I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.